Hello and welcome back to another week in the world of Angel Insights brought to you by Syndicate Room. This is a show that delves inside the world of early stage investing to reveal the tips, tactics and strategies of some of the best up and coming investors. Now joining me today we have Elizabeth Galbert. Now Elizabeth is a founding partner at SoGal Ventures, the first female-led cross-border venture capital firm. And prior to finishing business school, she founded A-Level Capital, the first student-led venture capital firm powered by John Hopkins students. And before graduate school, Elizabeth was a strategy and operations consultant at Deloitte Consulting, focusing on large healthcare clients. Outside of her client-facing work, Elizabeth contributed to business development efforts that led to over $200 million of new work. And if you love the show today with Elizabeth, then you can head over to syndicateroom.com and see all the previous episodes, as well as accompanying angel articles and resources. But for now, I'm delighted to hand over to Elizabeth Galbert, founding partner at SoGal Ventures. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here, so thanks for taking the time.
Of course, happy to be here, Harry.
Now, I'd love to start off today with how you made your way into the world of investing and into the world of venture. So what was your route in?
Yeah, so I think everyone's route in is a little different, and mine, in a sense, was very serendipitous and a bit unusual. So I started my career off as a strategy consultant in the healthcare space when digital health was really first emerging and the U.S. government was making a lot of mandates and regulations around that. And I was helping these large hospital systems, pharmaceutical companies, and even the U.S. government figure out what is their high-level tech strategy. Are they building things? Are they buying things? Are they doing some combination? Are they starting their own investment arm? Are they, you know, acquiring companies totally? Mm-hmm. And that was a very interesting time. At the time, I didn't really understand that these are startups. I thought, oh, these are small tech businesses with 2 to 3 founders and maybe an employee here or there. Everything was really in its very early stages in digital health. And then I decided I was going to go to grad school. And I went to this amazing program. It's an MBA from Johns Hopkins and a Master's of Art and Design at Maryland Institute College of Art. And on my first week there, I was basically handed this brand new entrepreneurship club from the graduating class. And they said, you know, we're graduating, please take this. And at the time, I hadn't really thought of entrepreneurship, although I had always been told I'm very entrepreneurial. And so I was like, okay, entrepreneurship, innovation, I can totally do this. And so within 2 years, we built up the club to 52 student leaders across Hopkins has 9 different schools. For example, the School of Medicine, the School of Engineering, the School of Education. And they're all geographically dispersed around Baltimore and the Maryland area. And it's pretty siloed and they don't communicate well. But there's all these amazing people in top-rated programs that are really tackling some of society biggest issues, such as, you know, healthcare, education, public health in the developing world, engineering, biomedical engineering. No one was really kind of bringing everyone together and making these multidisciplinary teams. And that's something that our student organization was really all about. And so we were running about an event a week and bringing in a bunch of angel and VC investors. And the common feedback we got was, wow, these are amazing, super talented teams. I like to say, you know, Stanford talent at Baltimore prices. But, you know, it's really risky and we don't really invest until there's, you know, at least $50,000 to $200,000 of angel and friends and family money in there. And so what I continuously saw over hundreds of these startup companies was you'd have very committed founding teams that were extremely technical and talented. But then everyone would end up in banking or consulting because that was sort of the job options that the Career Center really pushed. It really hit me when I actually went through something very personal. I was working with a student company that was doing a digital pathology in the cloud company that uses deep learning and computer visualization to improve how pathologists diagnose cancer. And I learned about a semester into my program that my dad had cancer. And not only that, but, you know, his pathology results in the past weren't correct. And so the cancer was actually a lot worse because of these errors. And these were the errors that this company was really setting out to fix, right? And I worked with a student for 2 years, really trying to find him an investor everywhere from New York, San Francisco, shopping him around, doing these events. And nobody wanted to be, you know, that first $10,000, $20,000, $50,000. And at the same time, we had run this venture capital investment competition, had a huge amount of participation, and Dorm Room Fund was really getting going. And I was like, you know, let's do something like this at Johns Hopkins. And so with that, not only did I end up writing him his first check of institutional money, but I also helped find him all the investors in his seed round so that when he graduated, he actually walked away with over a $1 million seed round, an awesome roster of investors, both in Baltimore and New York, and really ready to build his company. And so with that, I have 24 students that help manage the fund, and they're all, you know, VCs in training. And through that, I ended up at Stanford with Dave McClure and the 500 Startups team, where I then met my business partner, Pocket Sun. And it was That was May of 2015, and in April of that year, the Ellen Powell and Kleiner Perkins case had happened. And it was really a big discussion. Our group was almost half women, which the 500 Startups team did a wonderful job curating. And we were all a little, not angry, but, you know, how can we make a difference to really change the gender gap in venture capital? The statistics are awful. 77% of VC firms have never hired a woman in an investing role. Anywhere from 90 to 94% of venture capitalists are men. There's a few different stats. Yeah, so pretty bad. And we talked to a lot of famous, notable investors, many who we've interviewed. And Jason Calhanius was like, you know what? Like, you guys are just getting out of grad school. Take a year or two, try and raise a fund. Otherwise, you're just going to shop your resume around for a year or two and, you know, end up at a middle-tier firm that you may or may not enjoy. Like, this is the time. And so my business partner for SoGal Ventures, Pac and I were like, okay, this is our time. And she had built so far a community at that time. It was about 3,000 female entrepreneurs across California and a little bit Latin America. And since then, we've expanded it to over 10,000 members. But that was really the platform that we then built our fund off of. So I think looking back on it now, it's all a very natural progression. But at the time, it didn't seem very planned.
No, but a brilliant story all the same. And I mean, I'm intrigued that were you nervous in terms of taking the institutional checks, coming straight out of college and university and utilizing the networks that you had? Was that nerve-wracking considering the lack of traditional venture experience that often is prevalent in our industry?
Yeah, so I think everything in life can be nerve-wracking, especially when it's the first time that you do something. Mm-hmm. I'm really somebody who's a quick learner, and I like to consult, you know, 100 different pieces of research before deciding on my path forward and decision, and I'm really data-driven. I also know when to ask for help. So I developed this amazing network, some of them investors in the fund, of mentors that really asked any of those questions that seemed really stupid or not stupid at all as I've gone through this journey. And I mean, it's been incredible how much I've learned in the year I've been doing this.
What's been your biggest learning?
My biggest learning is I think that definitely everything's a bit like idealized in the media, and it creates this disconnect where entrepreneurs may not understand the complexity that VCs are dealing with on the back end. For example, raising money, reporting to your limited partners, all the legal work that goes into a deal. I mean, there's some deals have thousands of pages of legal work. And I think everyone thinks, you know, it's like a very fast process where it's okay, you raised $1 million, you're off to the races, and it all happened within a day. And that's not true. There's so much work that goes on both the entrepreneur side and the venture capitalist side. That's really important to know that you're getting into a partnership, and it needs to be a very transparent partnership, and it needs to be a very mutually beneficial partnership. And that takes time to build, both from a legal structure, investment structure, but then also your personal relationship as investor and entrepreneur.
In terms of timeframes, I'm always intrigued as to different investors' levels of diligence. What does your diligence look like, and how long do you kind of allocate towards it?
Yeah, so it really depends. For something like that digital pathology company where I had been building the relationship with the founder for 2 years, I knew so much about the market and I had basically been doing research for 2 years, it can move pretty quickly, you know, in a matter of a couple days. But for an industry that maybe I'm not that well read up on yet, or a founder that I just met, I typically like getting to know founders over multiple informal meetings. I don't do like a formal pitch me a PowerPoint. I really like sitting down, having a meal, going and doing an activity because I find it opens people up and it creates a much more sort of honest bond between you and the entrepreneur from the get-go. By not being that like intimidating, like sitting there watching and poking holes at somebody's idea or company, you know, it creates a much better platform for a fruitful relationship in the long run. So it's also taken, you know, months as well. Of course, it also depends on does the entrepreneur have all of their ducks in a row, like a deal room, you know, with all their legal documents, and are they registered properly as a Delaware C Corp. There's all these things that add time to the timeline if they aren't properly in place before you meet the entrepreneur.
Is it a challenge in terms of finding the balance? You said that absolutely about kind of finding activities, dinners, and really getting to know them on a personal level. Is there ever a kind of a difficult balance in terms of becoming their friend and their investor? Is it possible to be both a friend and an investor?
I think there is. I would probably create like a hybrid word, like a friendvestor or something like that. Because in the end of the day, right, it is a business relationship.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't mean a business relationship can't also be a friendship. And what I like to tell especially young entrepreneurs is this is a multi-iteration game. I'm a big game theory fanatic. but, you know, like they're not playing a single iteration game. So it's really important to not burn bridges in any iteration of your company or companies, right? Like if somebody's in their 20s now, they're going to have a completely different company, likely, in their mid-30s. And then they might be an investor in their 40s or some different arrangement of that. But the person and your reputation and your integrity and what people think of you, that stays the same no matter what company you're at or fund you're at, right?
Absolutely. In terms of kind of changing personal characteristics, behaviors, how have you looked to establish your pattern recognition for startups in the early days with SoGal and with A-Level?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting question. And of course, there is such a lack of diversity. About 2% of venture capital goes to female-led companies with a female CEO. And I think that all starts at the root, at like empathy and understanding. And so when you're trained as a designer, you take multiple courses on empathy and how you develop your sense of empathy and how you utilize that to create amazing products and services. I think the issue really lies with different people not having empathy for each other and thus creating pattern recognition. So for example, like think of times when you've just shrugged somebody off that comes up to you at a networking event because they don't seem from like a similar background as you, or they don't seem like they would be valuable to you. And I think a lot of times that happens at both the investor and the entrepreneur level. As a young female investor, it happens to me all the time from entrepreneurs. Oh, yeah, all the time. And it's kind of funny, right? But it also happens from the investor side all the time, too, of them not taking the time to, you know, quiet their minds a little bit about what your unconscious bias is already sort of giving you all these signals about. And then really take the time to like listen and give somebody the opportunity to actually connect with you.
Talking of kind of other investors there and talking of the kind of building the funding round for the pathology startup, I'd love to hear what you look for then in co-investors in the companies that you're investing in. What do you think makes a good co-investor?
Yeah, so I think, again, it's about partnership. There's, of course, going to be negotiations and little things that you may not agree about. But I think it's really important that you're all on the same page and also on the same page with the entrepreneur of where you see the company going, both short-term, mid-term, and long-term strategy, right? And I think it's important to have smart money. And I think smart money can be a variety of different skill sets. And you want to kind of round up all those different skill sets within your round of co-investors. So for example, if you're a fintech product that's targeting young millennials, and you have all of these corporate strategic investors who are sort of the established financial institutions, maybe try and get, for example, some investors who focus on millennials and consumer products, because you now have the skill set of the financial institutions, but add on what else you need, right? I think investors can be such a huge asset to somebody's company when they're used correctly and also sought out correctly, right? Like, seek out the investors that you think would really be valuable in building your company.
And then final question before we go into a quick fire, and that slightly touches on the strategic money on the other side of the table. Is all dumb money bad money?
Yes and no. So you don't want to take dumb money that includes control, right? So there's a difference of just the money and then the control aspects. So if you're taking dumb money and then putting it on a board seat, that's probably a bad idea. And I always say also, like, getting an investor is like getting married. This is a long-term relationship you're building. So you want to be doing diligence on the investor as well, making sure they're not actually going to be harmful to your company. But if you've done that and you've just determined, you know, they don't add any strategic value, but they're also in this indifferent spot where they're not going to negatively affect my company and there's no sort of control provisions in there, I think that's okay, especially if your company is something that's very capital intensive.
And I'd love to dive into a quick fire now. So I say a short statement and then you give me your immediate thoughts. About 60 seconds per one. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
So let's start with the biggest challenge in establishing SoGal.
Changing the paradigm in what folks think a venture capitalist can be. I think to be a venture capitalist, you have to be able to do the job. I don't think necessarily that means all of the other characteristics that most people typically say, such as exiting a company, working as employee number one at Google, being an associate at a firm, having an MBA. There's all these qualities that folks tend to say aligns with venture capitalists. But at the end of the day, you just have to do your job, right? Which is helping your portfolio companies and making as much money possible for your investors in the fund.
And then what's the vision for SoGal? Well, 5-10 years time, what's the roadmap ahead?
Yeah, so SoGal is going to be a global brand. So not only are we going to really change the diversity gap in just venture capital entrepreneurship, but we have a lot of, you know, fun plans for the future of expansion in different types of industry, product, and service verticals.
What's your favorite investing resource? It could be a blog, it could be a newsletter, it could be an author. What's your favorites?
My favorite is probably, I have like a whole list of both blogs and newsletters I get every day.
Okay.
And I put them automatically into a file and then read them all at once. And I think just the differences of opinions, right, and getting it from all angles, that's what's my favorite and very valuable.
Do you have one favorite one? Like mine would be Mattermark Daily.
I love Mattermark and what Danielle's been building. So that's definitely in there. Definitely like Mattermark, CB Insights, PitchBook. I actually love Bloomberg Business Week on like a printed out version. And then, of course, all the blogs like Fred's, Brad's, Joanne Wilson's, yeah, and many, many more.
And then let's do, what do you know now that you wish you'd known when you started out pre-A-level?
I probably wish that I had more confidence in that I could do this. There were definitely a couple months where both my business partner and I were struggling on a confidence spectrum. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of established investors that were really kind of putting us down and questioning our ability to accomplish what we set out to do. And luckily, because we have such a strong partnership, Pocket and I with SoGal, we were able to kind of pull each other out of these lacking confidence moments.
Yeah.
And that's what's really good about having a fantastic co-founder. But if I would go back, I would probably just put like a big sign on my mirror that's like, you can do it, stop being stupid, and like run, go forth and conquer.
And then I want to finish on your most recent public investment and why you said yes.
So one would be Sonovex Surgical, which is a super cool medical device plus software play that basically helps after a skin graft technique make sure that the blood flows correctly in the veins and that it doesn't happen to be like a failed surgery where they have to go do surgery again. And the reason I invested was it was just this amazing team from Johns Hopkins with great technology. And I like to really invest in healthcare products where there's a lot of broken value. So in this, for example, if you have to do the surgery again, the hospital doesn't get paid for it because they say it's the hospital's mistake and they don't receive any reimbursement.
Wow.
So there's this huge issue, right, and of these enormous hundreds of thousands of dollars of costs, plus, of course, the patient suffering, a much worse patient outcome. When I look at healthcare investments, I really look at who in the system is taxed. The American healthcare system is extremely complex with insurers, the patients, the providers, different layers of providers. And with any given problem, there's multiple stakeholders getting what I call taxed, right? Where the value isn't optimal. And so I like sort of looking at where can you sort of bridge those value gaps and either reduce costs and or increase revenue and profit.
Well, Elizabeth, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you so much for giving up the time to join me, and I look very forward to seeing the growth of SoGal.
Yeah, thank you so much, Harry.
And a huge hand to Elizabeth for giving up her time today to appear on the show. Absolutely fantastic to hear her journey with SoGal. And if you love the episode today, then head over to syndicateroom.com, where you can find a whole host of podcast episode, articles, resources, all on early stage investing. As always, we so appreciate your support listening to today's episode and look very forward to bringing you next week's episode.